Minnesota Court of Appeals is back in session. Judge Brian, Judge Jessen, Judge Klophockey, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. This is case number A21-1248, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Keith Allen Baker, Appellant.
Good morning, and thank you for being willing to participate in these remote hearings. I do have a couple of comments at the outset. First of all, the participants today are the attorneys and the judges. So that's who has the ability to speak and to share their screens or whose screens will be visible. And only those people will be able to participate today. When you're not speaking, we ask that you keep yourself muted. And because we are making an audio recording, we also ask that you state your name and the party that you represent before you begin. And I also want to make sure that I say that this audio recording is the only recording that we permit. There are no other permitted recordings that should be made. If you see the clock, sometimes people toggle into the active speaker view, and that makes the clock really small. But if you're in the gallery view, you should be able to see it and know how much time is remaining. So that might be something to think about if you're not able to see the clock, to make sure you toggle into the gallery view. Also, we understand that because of the nature of these remote proceedings, from time to time, there are technical problems or interruptions, doorbells, pets, that sort of thing. We'll try and keep them to a minimum, but we understand that they do happen from time to time. If for any reason you are unable to hear us or something goes wrong, please let us know and we'll do what we can to ensure you have all the time to which you're entitled. And with that, we'll begin with petitioner.
Go ahead, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Charles Klass, and I represent appellant Mr. Keith Allen Baker here today. We are here today because we have appealed Mr. Baker's convictions for first-degree criminal sexual conduct and second-degree criminal sexual conduct on the basis of sufficiency of the evidence. I would like to start my argument by addressing the state's initial argument, which makes the argument that essentially date of the offense is not an essential element. Therefore, it is not really relevant to a sufficiency of the evidence argument like we are making here today. Ultimately, Mr. Baker's case presents a very interesting procedural pattern when you look at how the jury decided his case. He was charged with four different counts, three first-degree counts, one second-degree count. The first-degree counts all are broken up into one-year increments, which cover a specific time period. The second-degree count covers basically the entirety of the first-degree count periods. The jury in this case ultimately acquitted Mr. Baker on two of the first-degree criminal sexual conduct counts, which sits at the outer edges of this time period that the offense covers. Ultimately, they convicted him on the first degree count, which sits in the very middle of this time period, and the second degree count, which covers the entire time period. The logic that we can draw from the jury's decision in this matter is ultimately that reasonable doubt existed with respect to the time periods of the two first-degree counts, which sits on the outer edges of this time period. Ultimately, if the jury was allowed to decide this way and base their decision on the fact that reasonable doubt existed for the lack of specificity as it applied to these time periods, I'm not sure how we can argue that ultimately the date of the offense is not an essential element of the offense and ultimately shouldn't be considered if, in fact, Mr. Baker was actually acquitted on two counts when it pertained to the date of the offense in this matter. This is further bolstered.
Counsel, there may be other reasons for acquittal on these other counts other than the time issue.
It's possible, and of course, the jury doesn't actually explain their verdict. However, I think based on the unique charging nature and how the counts were broken down in this case, we really are only left with one logical conclusion, that it had to be based on the timing of these charges and not based on a lack of evidence of other sexual conduct as alleged. The jury did convict him on the second degree count, which tells us, if we have to continue to infer into the jury's verdict here, that they did believe that the substance of what happened here did occur to an extent at some point. If they convicted on the second degree, I'm not sure how they could have acquitted on the two first degrees, but for this timing issue, given where they sat.
Seems to me you may have turned the logic on its head. If, in fact, the jury convicts on the broad time frame, the jury is concluding that the conduct occurred within that time frame. That's doesn't say anything about whether what the jury's thinking is on the two other first degree charges, it seems to me.
And Your Honor, what we would argue to that is that ultimately, this is a case when we look at the jury's decision of pure guesswork when it comes to not necessarily what may have happened, but what happened when it happened. Both in our brief and the state's brief, we have a nice outline of the conduct that the victim in this case alleged and about the time periods when she did allege that the conduct occurred. And also we discuss the testimony that may have contradicted at least the timelines of when this conduct would have been possible to have occurred. So again, if we're looking into the jury's decision and understanding that they did convict on two of the counts, our opinion is that we're left with a conclusion that ultimately, while they may have believed that this conduct occurred, if they are acquitting on the two outer edges, they are ultimately guessing, throwing a dart at the wall as to when it may have occurred, guessing sometime in the middle of this time frame. And that ultimately is not sufficiency of the evidence. That is, in fact, reasonable doubt if we are left to infer that the jury would have had to guess as to the timing of when any of this conduct that they may have believed occurred actually did occur.
I have a hard time getting past, given that our standard of view looking at sufficiency of the evidence, that the jury believed the complainant. And we have case law that says, look, the state doesn't need to prove this. These sorts of crimes happen on a particular day or even a particular month. We can look at broad time frames. The only thing that's important, I think, but here, correct me if I'm wrong, is the age difference, right? And the fact that the complainant here, wasn't yet 13 or 16, kind of depending on the count. I mean, so how am I wrong? Explain to me how I'm wrong about that, because I'm just having a hard time following your logic here.
And so, yes, Your Honor, we do agree that ultimately the kind of first important question when you're talking about timing is whether or not it negates an age element of the offense. We agree we don't have that here. What we think makes this case unique is the fact that Mr. Baker was actually acquitted on two counts as it pertains to the timeline. I understand the court may disagree in terms of my inference that the timeline actually was the main driving factor there. But as we look at it, if we are allowing him to be acquitted on two counts and the jury found that reasonable doubt doesn't exist as it pertains to these two counts, again, based on argument, based on timeline, then why shouldn't the inverse apply with respect to the counts that he was acquitted on, where we believe the evidence still shows that there is this lack of specificity that bothered the jury on the acquitted counts that should have continued to bother them in their reasonable doubt pursuit on the counts that he was ultimately convicted of.
So, Mr. Klass, as we're looking at the elements of the offense, you're asking us to consider the jury's decision to acquit in deciding that timing is actually an element in this case. It's a basis to distinguish or to not apply previous case law to the contrary. So do you see that as a new rule of law that this panel would be articulating? Or is there some authority that we would look to that says we look to the jury's decisions to acquit in deciding what the elements of the offense are for purposes of sufficiency of the evidence?
Your Honor, this would have to be a new rule of law here that we would be considering. I have no authority to actually consider this. And I do believe that again, this case is unique in this one respect in terms of the charging of the counts and the breakdown of the timelines with respect to the counts. And then ultimately, of course, the jury's verdict here. And so, yes, there is no support that I was able to find that would say you can look to their acquittal counts when evaluating their convicted counts. But I think it makes complete logical sense here to, in fact, do that. I do recognize there may be an initial concern over the logical consistency or inconsistency of this argument, in that if we're saying obviously that they're allowed to acquit, then why aren't they allowed to convict? And again, my response to that would be, the fact that they acquitted on these two counts is all the reason we need to look into their verdict on the convicted counts and say, if they had this concern on the acquitted counts, how can they not have the same concern on the convicted counts when it comes to reasonable doubt and the timeline? That is ultimately the argument that we really are making here.
So you would have us use a heightened scrutiny in reviewing the sufficiency in the evidence where the defendant has been acquitted of a couple of counts. Is that what this comes down to?
Your Honor, I'm not sure if it is necessarily a heightened level of scrutiny. Ultimately, the same standards.
Well, yeah, because we're supposed to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. But I hear you saying, and in consideration of the fact that your client was acquitted of two counts. That's why I was trying to say, so it wouldn't be as heightened. I don't want to put words in your mouth, counsel.
Right. I think I agree with you, Your Honor, in that we're saying it. Essentially, this is the same standard. It's just a very unique way of looking at it and kind of a fresh way of looking at it, again, that I think maybe doesn't come up as much because of how that...
Doesn't your argument suppose and presume that the acquittals were based upon jury's concern for time frame?
It does, Your Honor.
And we don't know that to be true, do we?
Not officially, Your Honor. No, we don't.
You'd like it to be true because that would make your argument consistent, but we don't know that. So if we don't know that, then why should we place any reliance on it in assessing the guilty verdict?
Well, Your Honor, I think we are allowed to ultimately infer what we can based on the record. And the testimony shows that the victim in this case testified to incidences that covered a certain time frame as alleged here, and that ultimately he was convicted on a time frame in the middle of this broader timeline and a count that just basically includes all 3 years where something could have occurred at any time during the middle of this time frame. So if you are acquitting on the outer edges, I understand
if the acquittal was because of the outer edges, but so the jury just decides we've got a lot of counts here, we're going to convict on some and acquit on some.
Yes, and ultimately
we don't know what was going in the mind of the jury in making those acquittal and deciding to acquit on these two outer edges.
We ultimately don't. My argument will continue to be, though, I think there is enough kind of cold logic as it relates to the record that we can draw a decently strong inference, but I would never say or argue here today that we know with 100% certainty that is obviously what drove their decision in the jury room. No. But I believe that, again, for the sake of this argument, you can make those inferences as they applied to the jury's decision-making in this case when it comes to evaluating whether or not they had sufficiency of the evidence to convict on the two middle counts, so to speak.
I have to say that asking us to draw inferences kind of scares me a little bit, because that's the kind of thing that fact finders do, and we're not in the position of being a fact finder.
I think, Your Honor, we're hitting at the difficulty, obviously, of sufficiency of the evidence cases where we are trying to figure out whether or not a jury made the right call, and the only thing that we can base it on is the cold record of the evidence presented at trial. I will just continue to say that, again, I think this is a unique scenario factually when it comes to the charging decisions and how it was broken down. And while this may be uncharted territory to an extent in terms of how we've decided these cases in the past, the uniqueness of the charging decisions in this case may give reason to go out on a limb and make inferences that we can make based on the cold record and not just throw our hands up and say we're never going to be able to get inside that jury room in the minds of the jury, when there is some logic here based on the record that I believe does allow us to do that. And whether or not it would be 100%, it's not going to be 100%, but if it's something less than 100%, again, if logic supports it, I believe a decision could be made based on those inferences. I have no further argument at this time. If the court has any more questions, I will answer them. Otherwise, I rest.
Thank you very much. Ms. Pepin.
Good morning, Your Honors, Mr. Klass. My name is Heather Pipenhagen. I am an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the state of Minnesota, who is the respondent in this case. The first thing I want to point out, and I think this is really clear, that appellant's argument really is confusing the issue of offense date with an element of the offense, which is the age of the victim. And in this case, the reason why the offense date is not an element or a critical element, unlike the two unpublished cases cited by appellant, is because the victim in this case, without a doubt, was under 16 and in fact under 13 the entire time of all these offenses. I believe she wasn't even 13 yet at the time that she testified. So the offense date and the elements, the offense date is not critical to an element. And the case law is clear that offense date itself is not an element. It can become important if it affects the age of the victim. That is not the case here. So moving then, to the sufficiency of the evidence. So even notwithstanding the fact that offense date is not an issue here, even if offense date was, the evidence in this case overwhelmingly supports the jury's verdicts on count one and count three. And first of all, because that's really the important issue, is what evidence supported the counts they convicted on. I want to talk about that first. And second, assuming I have time, I'll get to it. This issue of what do the acquittals mean is a red herring in this case. And I think the acquittals are very easily explained by the evidence in this case, but I'll get to that second. So the first issue, the sufficiency for the counts that he was convicted on. Count one, the second degree, what Mr. Klass never actually acknowledged in his argument is these counts, count one and count three, they are defined by completely different acts. Count one is contact. Count three is penetration. That is a different burden for the state, a different element, a different act that the state has to prove. So count one, clearly the jury believed there was sexual contact during this entire time that this victim was 8, 9, and 10. And they found him guilty of that. That count, that contact, that behavior was charged in that 3-year time frame. Now, moving to count three, the criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. In this case, the prosecuting attorney chose, which was not me and I can't explain, chose to charge the first degree in 1-year chunks based on the victim's age, age 8, age 9, and part of age 10. She could have just charged one count of criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, covering that entire time period like she did for the second degree, but she did not. But there's not a problem with that. It just made the jury's job, and frankly, the state's job, a little bit harder because it made the jury have to decide when it got the specific instruction on each count. The way they're instructed is, did the defendant commit penetration on this victim during this time frame?
So if I can jump in here, because I think the argument Mr. Klass may be making is that by nature of charging it that way, our sufficiency of the evidence review requires us to answer that same question. Is there sufficient evidence that there was an act that occurred in that time frame?
Absolutely.
And we have to consider what evidence was there during that time frame. And so it's not so much that time frame becomes an element of the offense, but that because that's the only conviction, we're limited to, does the evidence support that conviction? So
Yes, and that is my argument, that that is all the court has to worry about. Is there sufficient evidence to support that conviction? And again, I'll talk about the acquitted counts in a minute.
Right, but you can't then say, you can't then say because she was under age 13 the entire time, therefore there's sufficient evidence. We have to look at what was the timing of a, is there a specific incident that falls within that year?
And there is. There was clear evidence when she gave her statement to Detective Myrie, and this was admitted as substantive evidence at trial. When she was 9 years old, she performed oral sex on him. That was, she clearly stated it was when she was 9 years old. Then at trial, when she testified, when she was asked about it, she wasn't as specific at trial. They talked about, again, her performing oral sex on him. And the ejaculation that occurred during that time, or the liquid that came out. And she was asked, in the range of you being 8 to 10, when did that happen? And she said, in the middle. So her testimony, her trial testimony was a little bit more ambiguous, but her statement to Detective Myrie was clear. It was when she was 9 years old. So, I mean, that's, I think, the first and most important argument is the evidence is clearly sufficient to support the jury's finding on that count. And, you know, it is the time frames as instructed, as the jury is instructed, it does say on or about. But I don't even think we need to be that flexible because her testimony was so clear that it occurred when she, or her statement to Detective Myrie was clear that it occurred when she was nine. So then moving to the acquitted counts. This is why they make sense. I completely disagree with Mr. Class's argument that that means the jury somehow didn't believe there was penetration. There was only one incident that she described where she performed oral sex on the defendant, and that was when she was nine. She talked about two other acts that happened with the defendant that constitute penetration. One, what she described, when he would touch her vagina, he would touch her on the inside and the outside. And I know the prosecutor kind of tried to get her to explain that a little bit more, but you know, we're taking testimony from a child. The prosecutor would say, now, what do you mean by inside? Was it inside or outside? And she said both, on the inside and the outside. To some jurors, that might clearly describe penetration. To other jurors, a juror may have said, that's not enough for me. That I can't find beyond a reasonable doubt that saying touch me on the inside and outside constitutes digital penetration. For those actions, him touching her vagina on the inside and out, she talked about that happening throughout the three-year time period. She wasn't very specific about dates, unlike when she performed oral sex on him. So it makes complete sense that the jury, in looking at that, was like, well, I don't know if that was penetration or not. Another incident that she talked about was when he licked her all the way up her leg, up to her private area. And again, she doesn't do a very good job describing it, but again, it's testimony from a child. But it certainly sounds from her testimony like the defendant performed oral sex on her. There was contact with his mouth, with her vaginal area. Unfortunately, she did not do a great job of fleshing out when the date was of that conduct either. So it makes complete sense what the jury is looking at. They believed what this victim said, but they said, we don't really know what these other acts of penetration, what they were, if they really were penetration, and when exactly they occurred, because she didn't tell us. But what she did tell us is she performed oral sex on him when she was 9 years old. And that is count three. And there is sufficient evidence for that count. The fact that they didn't really know what happened when she was eight, and maybe they weren't sure that it was penetration. Maybe it was one juror. Again, we weren't in the deliberation. We don't know. Maybe there was one juror that said, when she says touched in and out, I don't know that that means digital penetration. So that one juror was only willing to go with count three. Same with the oral sex. We didn't have a solid timeline on that. And again, the jury isn't really instructed on the law as we're talking about here. The jury doesn't get the law that says offense date is not an element of the offense. They get this jury instruction that says very specifically on each count, did he penetrate her between these two dates? And they are going to follow those instructions as they should. So they really took that job seriously. They focused on that. They analyzed the facts. And their guilty verdict on count three and not guilty verdict on two and four is not at all a reflection of the sufficiency of the evidence on count three. And unless there's any other questions, I don't have anything to add.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We will now move to Mr. Klass for rebuttal.
Thank you. I have no rebuttal argument. I am happy to answer any questions from the.
All right. Well, with that, we'll conclude the oral argument and take the matter under advisement.